This is the Global News podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nikki Cardwell, and at 1400 GMT on Thursday, the 19th of September, these are our main stories. The Civil Aviation Authority in Lebanon has banned pagers and walkie-talkies from all flights out of Beirut Airport following the targeting of Hezbollah's communication devices. There have been more exchanges of fire between Israel and the militants. The Israeli security services say they've arrested an Israeli businessman allegedly recruited by Iran to assassinate Prime Minister Netanyahu. Also in this podcast, artificial intelligence needs global oversight and developing nations need a voice, according to the United Nations. And the late billionaire and former Harrods boss Mohammed Al-Fayed is accused of rape by former staff.
He was trying to get in my room in quite an aggressive manner. It was absolutely terrifying.
We have a special report. The authorities in Israel say an Israeli businessman is being held in custody over an extraordinary plot to assassinate leading politicians. The security services allege 72-year-old Moti Maman travelled to Iran twice and was paid to kill the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Defence Minister, or the Director of the Domestic Security Agency. Yaron Benjamin is a senior police officer.
An incident that sets a new bar of severity and audacity that we've not yet known. We're talking about an Israeli who, during a war, during the State of Israel's toughest time, enters Iran, holds a meeting with Iranian intelligence agents who ask him to help in a plan to assassinate senior figures in the State of Israel.
Across Israel's northern border in Lebanon, there's continuing turmoil after two consecutive days of exploding communications devices. Both pagers and walkie-talkies have now been banned on flights out of Beirut Airport. Najat Saliba is a member of the Lebanese parliament with the coalition Takadum. What are her feelings after the two waves of attacks?
So the first one is sadness because of the number of injured people. The second is in awe of how destructive this massacre was. And the third is also some kind of disparity of what is next and how bad does it get.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Yoland Nell. Alex Ritson began by asking her about that alleged assassination plot.
An Israeli court has actually lifted today a gag order on this spying case, revealing that this man, Moti Maman, a 72-year-old Jewish Israeli from Ashkelon in the south, has been charged with being recruited by Iran to assassinate senior Israeli officials, including the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Defence Minister, or the head of the Shin Bet spy agency. And really, you know, he's said to have attended at least two meetings in Iran himself with somebody who'd been working as a businessman in Turkey for quite a lot of time. And it's a really intriguing case that just reminds you of the ongoing shadow war between Israel and Iran. Last week, we had the Shin Bet uncovering what it said was a plot by Hezbollah as an Iranian-backed group to assassinate the former defense minister, Moshe Yalon.
This perhaps puts current events, though, into a wider context, because although we only just found out about it, the leaders of Israel would have known about this as they were planning, well, the current series of actions.
Indeed, there's just so much that's going on at the moment. I have to say, though, on the ground, away from this assassination plot, as much as tensions remain extremely high after the attack on the Hezbollah communication devices that's been attributed to Mossad, although Israel is not officially commenting, not saying that its spy agency was behind that in any way. We've got on the ground events that look very similar to what we've seen over the past 11 months. We've been hearing from the Israeli military that it carried out airstrikes hitting Hezbollah targets, it says, in southern Lebanon. Israeli media reporting that a number of Israelis have been wounded by anti-tank missile fire from Lebanon. And, you know, yesterday Hezbollah fired about 20 different rockets into Israel, most of which were intercepted by the air defence systems without causing any injuries, according to what the Israeli military has told us.
And yet it does feel like Israel has stepped up its war aims by at least one gear.
Well, the Israeli Defense Minister has said this is a new phase of operations. Israel's not making it clear if it's expecting to go to all-out war with Hezbollah or just increase its focus on that northern border. It's been adding troops, a whole division that was recently fighting in Gaza that includes commandos and paratroopers. It's put more military resources along that border, and it's really been emphasising different leaders coming out saying they're committed to this new war goal that they have set of returning tens of thousands of displaced Israeli citizens to their homes in the north. And previously the indications have been that Israel was wanting to push Hezbollah away from the border. That could involve a ground assault.
And as we recorded this podcast, the head of Hezbollah was due to give a speech following the blasts in recent days. We'll bring you the latest developments in the next edition of the Global News podcast. For this assessment of what might happen next, my colleague Nick Robinson spoke to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
I'm picking up from people I'm speaking to that there's a great deal of concern, including among Israel's Western allies, that the moment that people have feared for a long time, a wider Middle East war, is looming. And that, of course, has been, you know, an argument well rehearsed over the months. That, of course, might have catastrophic consequences for, well, not just people in the region, but it will have reverberations across the globe if it happens. Let's hope it doesn't.
Reverberations around the globe in what way?
Well, I think the history shows that events that happen in the Middle East tend not to stay in the Middle East. And you can't predict exactly the way it's going to work out, but there are always vibrations and consequences in terms of movements of people, in terms of organizations taking action against, say, for example, allies of Israel. I was in Lebanon in the war in 2006, and also an earlier large-scale Israeli attack in 1996. Israel has a long record of intervening in Lebanon, and actually a long record of having to retreat because it hasn't gone the way that they hoped for. The 1982 war was called Operation Peace for Galilee by the Israelis. The US fears that the wider war might happen and that they might get dragged in. They have a diplomatic plan, an envoy who's been working assiduously over the month to try to bring it to fruition. And while he has a framework, it depends really, I think, from the Hezbollah side on whether or not there is a ceasefire in Gaza. These things are connected, and the efforts to get a ceasefire in Gaza are not bearing fruit. So the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said that it's imperative all parties refrain from any actions that could escalate the conflict. But clearly at the moment, Israel has been escalating. There were those assassinations in Beirut and in Tehran earlier in the summer, and the last 2 days there's been a really significant escalation by the Israelis, and also their rhetoric has gone up a notch as well, and they're moving troops to the border. Now, these may be precautions, and they may simply be demonstrations and part of a great game of trying to put pressure on them, on Hezbollah, without taking military action. But the fact is that you can't keep in international affairs, you can't keep going to the brink, which has happened repeatedly over the last year, without the risk that you might tumble over it.
Events in the Middle East are playing a big role in the US presidential election, and there's special attention being paid in Michigan, which has a large Arab American population. It's also one of the crucial swing states which will determine whether Kamala Harris or Donald Trump will be the next president. With polling suggesting the race between the two is very close, every vote will count. Katrina Perry has been to Michigan to take the electoral temperature.
The city of Dearborn is home to the biggest Arab American and Muslim American populations in the US. The economy, cost of living, immigration, all issues concerning voters here. But the Middle East crisis is top of the list. Concern for family and friends in Gaza has spread to worries about those in Lebanon, as exploding devices killed dozens and injured thousands this week.
It's heartbreaking just knowing that our tax money and our hard work is helping fund this.
These business owners, longtime Democrats, feel abandoned by the Biden-Harris administration in its continued support for Israel.
You have somebody that's claiming to be a Democrat somebody is claiming to be a Republican and they're parroting the exact same platforms, who can cause more damage, who can cause more destruction.
The thought of voting for someone who's directly contributing, right now, directly contributing to the death and destruction of our home country and of our relatives overseas. I've made the decision to vote for Jill Stein. And I know that there are people who will say, you know, it's a wasted vote.
Sam Hamoud is the owner of the Sahara Cafe.
We asked for a ceasefire. We never received a ceasefire. I mean, we're running out of words.
As a local employer, he says inflation is crippling him.
I use a lot of flour. I bake my own bread here. For example, in September 21, I brought down a pallet of 40-pound bags of flours. It cost me $13.78 a bag. Today, it's costing me $21.92 a bag.
How is things going here?
Kaisal Sawafi runs an auto parts manufacturing business. He's created 1,000 jobs in the last 25 years.
Each party has pros and cons, and some they carry positive stuff and some negative stuff. So we are still undecided which way to go.
It's a clearer choice for Dr. Bilal Nasser.
Trump, he's offering to stop the war, so during his 4 years of presidency, we haven't experienced any wars. And the economy was booming, actually.
In 2020, Joe Biden won Michigan by 2.78%. In 2016, Donald Trump won by just 0.23%. And the campaigns know it's going to be tight again this year. They're peppering the state with multiple visits. In the last week alone, Donald Trump, Kamala Harris, J.D. Vance and Tim Walz have all made trips to Michigan.
Cybersecurity experts have told BBC News that Russia, China and Iran all have plans to disrupt the US presidential election. The Microsoft Threat Analysis Center says efforts by Kremlin-aligned groups have been derailed by the Democrats' recent change in candidate. Our artificial intelligence correspondent Mark Chislak reports from New York.
Sea of calm, away from the tourists and traffic, this is where we find MTAC, the Microsoft Threat Analysis Center.
Let's take a look now at an actor, or former employees of the Russian Ministry of Defense.
Here, specialist analysts, many with military intelligence backgrounds, detect and disrupt cyber-enabled influence threats to democracies worldwide. Reports they compile advise governments like the UK and US about these risks.
Individuals from this organization serve on a special presidential committee.
Former FBI special agent and now head of MTAC, Clint Watts, tells me Russian-aligned plans to interfere with the US election have been thrown into disarray by Kamala Harris's run for president.
The biggest impact of the switch of President Biden for Vice President Harris has been it's really thrown the Russians so far off their game. They had focused everything really on President Biden. Had going back to 2018-19, they really focused on Biden as somebody they needed to remove from office to get what they wanted in Ukraine. Today, that has changed almost entirely.
Watts goes on to tell me Russian groups aren't the only ones engaging in this kind of activity.
Iran has just entered the fold in recent months, using both cyber attacks and influence operations to try and cause chaos. Then China, in previous cycles, we saw almost nothing from China. But in this case, we do see them establishing social media accounts and websites, which they use to provoke some sort of conversations with American voters. And this is the first cycle where we've had all three that we can definitely point to.
Sana Sakari is an MTAC threat analyst. She tells me that AI is being used in influence campaigns, but in a much more mundane way than many might expect.
We found that in the source code for these websites, they were doing was using AI to rewrite content from a real place and using that for the bulk of their website. And then occasionally they would write real articles when it was a very specific political point they were trying to make.
The US Department of Justice has separately accused Russia and Iran of election interference, recently seizing 32 websites, it says, used AI to try and spread Russian disinformation. With 7 weeks to go, cybersecurity companies and intelligence agencies remain on high alert to online attempts to interfere with an election that has global consequences.
And it's not just election officials that are worried about AI. The United Nations has published a report condemning the current governance of artificial intelligence as a patchwork of guidelines dominated by just a handful of wealthy countries. The UN's report, commissioned by the General Secretary Antonio Guterres, urged states to create an international committee that includes developing nations in AI governance. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
If I had a pound for every treaty, code, guideline, set of principles and so on that I've read about AI safety in the last couple of years, I think I'd be talking to you from my own tropical island right now, because there's been so many of them. But the whole time there's also been voices saying we don't need all of this. What we need is a UN level oversight, you know, just like we have on climate change. And now that's exactly what this report, which has been commissioned by the UN itself, is recommending, along with a global AI fund to enable more countries to access AI tools and training. What's really interesting to note, I think, is the spread of power, if you like, among all of these conversations, because they are very much centered around rich Western countries. The report authors looked at a sample of those biggest treaties and declarations that we've had lately, and it found that only 7 countries have signed up to all of them, and they include the UK and the US and Canada and France. And there were 118 UN member states that haven't signed up to any of them at all. And guess what? They're all largely based in the global south. So we've got a really uneven distribution here of where even the conversations about AI safety and control are having. And on the other hand, we've got this enormously powerful and rapidly evolving technology that's coming at us very fast and is threatening to disrupt lots of people's lives all over the world.
Zoe Kleinman reporting. Later.
Mud, mud, glorious mud. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me.
The importance of the seabed in preventing climate change. The BBC has revealed that the late Mohammed Al-Fayed, former owner of the famous London department store Harrods, has been accused of rape by 5 female ex-employees. Mr. Al-Fayed, an Egyptian-born businessman, rose from a poor family in Alexandria to buying the world-famous shop in 1985. A BBC documentary has uncovered evidence that under Mohammed Al-Fayed's ownership, Harrods not only failed to intervene, but helped cover up abuse allegations. This report from Shaima Khalil contains description of sexual violence.
Yeah, I went back to Harrods about a year ago. And I knew if I could walk through and come out the other side, I'd be in a good place to be talking to you.
I joined Harrods because I wanted to be a buyer, and I ended up working for an absolute monster.
When Mohammed Al-Fayed took over Harrods, the world-famous department store, he quickly embraced his high-profile role and the status that came with it. To his customers and the celebrity guests, he was all charm. But to many of his female employees, he was a different man, a predator. We've heard testimony from more than 20 of Al-Fayed's female ex-employees.
He tried to rape me more than once.
And he pushed me in and onto the bed so that I couldn't move.
You know, he was 79, nearly 80, and I was 15.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was rich and powerful. That power allowed him to carry out assault at scale over decades.
I was in France and he'd come upstairs into my room. I was absolutely terrified.
Sophia worked as his personal assistant for 3 years, starting in 1988.
Got into bed with me, was trying to kiss me and push himself on me. And I don't know how I did it. I just kicked him off. I kicked and kicked and kicked and kicked and screamed. And again, I got him off. I was just terrified.
We also spoke to Gemma, who worked as Al-Fayed's personal assistant for 2 years in the late 2000s.
I think Mohammed Al-Fayed is a rapist. I think he's a serial rapist. I joined in 2007 and it was my first job in London. His behaviour was become more scary while I was on the trips. My first trip was actually to Abu Dhabi and he was trying to get in my room in quite an aggressive manner. It was absolutely terrifying. Just didn't know which way to turn. So I bought a small dictaphone that I had in my pocket. And these are the transcripts from those recordings. One of them was in Paris, in his residence there, Villa Windsor. I said, I just want to go to sleep on my own. Mr. Fired, I don't want to, Mr. Fired. And he kept saying, relax, please relax. Like, how can you relax when you're in that situation? He walked out and he was angry.
Not long after this incident, Gemma says Al-Fayed raped her. The BBC has heard testimony from four other women who say he raped them at his properties. In 2009, Gemma contacted a lawyer who told Harrods she was leaving her job on the grounds of sexual harassment. She didn't feel able to disclose the more serious allegations at the time. They agreed to pay a settlement if she signed a non-disclosure agreement. There was also one other condition.
The lawyers organised for a shredding truck to come to my lawyer's office, where we placed everything in. It was shredded in front of us, including tapes I had of him, my phone that had messages and voicemails, really quite nasty voicemails on them. Someone from HR was present for the shredding of all of the evidence I had. I thought I'd lost the transcripts, but actually what I did have was the transcriptions sent to my lawyer in my sent items of my email account at the time.
In a statement, the current owners of Harrods say they were utterly appalled by the allegations and that employees who are his victims had been failed, for which they sincerely apologised. They also said that the Harrods of today is a very different organisation to the one owned and controlled by Al-Fayed between 1985 and 2010. There were several attempts to expose Al-Fayed before his death, but it is only now that many of the survivors feel able to speak publicly about the abuse. For those who have, the silence and the taboo are finally broken.
For more on this, the new season of World of Secrets from the BBC World Service is available right now wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And the documentary, Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, is coming soon on the BBC News Channel on TV and, if you're in the United States or Canada, on BBC Select. A man has been arrested in Tbilisi on suspicion of murdering the most prominent transgender woman in Georgia. The 26-year-old is accused of stabbing Kazaria Abramidze to death in her home on Wednesday. Rehan Dimitri is in Tbilisi.
The model and actor had more than 500,000 followers on Instagram, and her openness about identity was considered an act of bravery in the country, which has seen a number of violent homophobic riots organised by far-right groups. Her murder took place a day after Georgia's parliament passed a new law on family values and the protection of minors. It imposes further restrictions on LGBTQ rights, including a continuing ban on same-sex marriages and gender-affirming medical treatment.
For more on the legislation from the governing Georgian Dream Party that curbs LGBT rights, my colleague Emilio Criccio has been speaking to Tamar Jokeli, a queer activist and the founder of the Tbilisi Pride Group.
When the Georgian Dream, the ruling party, announced the bill, it was very clear that they wanted to basically use this bill in order to animate their conservative electorate, in order to appeal to the people who live in the regions of Georgia who are very traditional and who are nostalgic about the way that life was back in the Soviet Union. But of course, on a personal level, I am devastated and disappointed that this is actually what Georgia has come to. When several years ago we were progressing towards having more advanced rights, towards greater equality and freedom, now we are regressing at an alarming rate.
In recent months, Georgia was in the headlines as the government looked to pass an anti-foreign agents bill that sparked mass demonstrations. In your opinion, is there a connection between that bill and this anti-LGBT propaganda bill?
Yes, there is definitely a connection between the foreign agents bill and the anti-LGBT bill. Both of them are designed to censor and to make life difficult, basically, for the people who are progressive, for the people who are fighting for democracy here. And on the one hand, we have this foreign agent bill that targets civil society, including us as Tbilisi Pride, because we have been one of the primary targets of this bill, but also the rest of the civil society, organizations that are monitoring the elections, organizations that are giving out services, that are working on women's rights and so on. And then on the other hand, we have this anti-LGBT bill, which basically, this bill gives the government authority to disperse any rally, any demonstration which features an openly LGBT person or which features something about same-sex couples. So this bill is also about censorship, and it's going to censor books and movies and theater plays, and you have to cut out scenes featuring LGBT people from movies or from books or from theater plays. And this really feels like authoritarian. This really feels like Soviet Union all over again.
And the Tbilisi Pride group is a really significant group when it comes to queer activism, not only in Georgia, but in the wider region, in the South Caucasus. What could this bill mean for the activities of your group, of the Tbilisi Pride group?
Our activities are going to be totally banned, I would say. We have already been unable to hold activities. Like this summer, in summer of 2024, we were unable to hold Pride events. I would say everybody is feeling really panicked, even more so than me. I'm just that kind of person, but most people around me are actually very stressed out and anxious and panicked. And a lot of people have already been packing their stuff and emigrating abroad, especially queer people. We have had a lot of farewell parties recently of queer people who are also very visible, who are not really feeling safe to stay. But yeah, if the community really leaves, then what are these changes even for? Like, who are we going to celebrate victory with if the community leaves?
That was Tamar Jokeli, a queer activist and the founder of the Tbilisi Pride Group. The International Energy Agency has warned that Ukraine faces its most challenging winter yet when it comes to ensuring energy supplies. Intense Russian attacks have severely depleted its generating capacity and grid. Is our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard.
In a report, the IEA said Ukraine could see electricity shortfalls of a third of peak demand this winter. Russian attacks of unprecedented scale earlier this year, it said, meant Ukraine could only generate about a third of the electricity it could pre-war, even before the latest strikes. The IEA is recommending 10 steps to help Ukraine, bolstering air defences being the most important, but also speeding up deliveries of equipment and spares and improving ways of supplying it with gas and electricity from the EU. The agency is also warning of the threat to Moldovan energy supplies.
There's currently a renewed momentum for a diplomatic solution to the war in Sudan. The conflict broke out last year between the regular army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Millions have been driven from their homes and famine has been declared in some areas. Earlier this week, the US President Joe Biden called for the warring sides to engage in talks. The BBC's former Sudan correspondent James Cottnell asked the US Special Envoy to Sudan, Tom Perriello, about the timing of this diplomatic push.
Well, we're talking about a situation that's in some ways unprecedented in recent history. We've got 1 million people facing starvation, but 20 million facing acute hunger. We're talking about a situation where sexual slavery is being used as a weapon of war along with starvation. And we've been trying to get talks going for many, many months. And President Biden said, look, we got to go forward with these talks in August. We gathered a group of diplomatic partners. We started to get access routes open. We're moving food by the tons, by the millions of pounds, but it's not even nearly enough relative to the scale of the crisis. And I think President Biden wanted to continue to escalate that pressure.
One of the main focuses of the fighting right now, and of course there are many across the country, is El Fasher in the western Darfur region, North Darfur, with the RSF besieging it. Is it your sense that it is now a critical moment in terms of trying to save, in particular, civilian lives there as the RSF closes in on the city?
It's a horrific situation, and we certainly need to think about the hundreds of thousands of civilians who are stuck in the city or have managed to escape as far as the Zamzam camp, but still are facing a desperate need for food and medicine. We've been trying to get in emergency convoys. But we have to end this fighting. We need the RSF to pull back from the siege and the joint forces and the army to agree to that ceasefire. And that's just for El Fasher. We're talking about a country of 50 million people across a tremendous diversity of ethnic groups. all facing this crisis with so little attention from the international community. So we really appreciate that President Biden and Secretary Blinken have focused, that our partners, including the Egyptians, are trying to figure out a way to end this horrific crisis.
One thing we hear a lot from Sudanese is frustration at the international community, perhaps America above all, treating both of the main warring parties the same, Sudanese Armed Forces and the RSF. On the one hand, they did this. On the other, they did this. Do you perceive them as equal? Or do you see, as many Sudanese, for example, say, that the RSF is committing the majority of the crimes against civilians, that more civilians are suffering at the RSF's hands than at the hands of others?
We don't see them as equal. We see, and our sanctions show this, a greater level of atrocities from the RSF, but we also hold the army to a higher standard because it wants to be seen as the legitimate army and the sovereign power. And therefore, when it does things like shut down the border to food and medicine to reach the most vulnerable, we do expect more of them. And so I think right now, we don't see two equal sides. We see two different sides. But we also remember this crisis was created because the two sides that are fighting now joined forces to overthrow the civilian democratic transition that the Sudanese people dreamed of.
Finally, in this podcast,
mud, mud, glorious mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So
well, it might be mud to Flanders and Swan, but to some conservationists, it's blue carbon, the sediment and silt on the seabed that holds huge quantities of organic carbon. And the worry is that by disturbing it, for example, by building wind farms, it might release carbon into the atmosphere, boosting global warming. Ruth Williams is the head of marine conservation at the Wildlife Trust here in Britain.
It's kind of the unsung hero of our seas. Unfortunately, these seabed sediments in particular, but other blue carbon habitats, our salt marshes and our seagrass, are at risk of disturbance. And particularly the muds, they're disturbed by bottom trawled gear, fishing gear that really destroys the top surfaces of those muds. And offshore development, where cables are laid across, moorings are inputted to that sediment. And it's really awareness of that disturbance that we want to raise.
So in other words, if you're going to put up a wind farm, which clearly is being done in part because of dealing with climate change, all those cables that are kind of come from the wind farm onto our shores, what could you do then to protect the mud that's disturbed as a result?
What we're calling for is a whole system approach. This report recognises the importance of blue carbon. What we now need to see is better strategic planning of activities at sea and to use the network of marine protected areas, our nature reserves at sea, much more effectively to protect not just the biodiversity, the wildlife that lives in these areas, but also this blue carbon, this incredible, valuable resource as well. So we want to mandate all activities under that impact assessment system, because these damaging activities are still allowed in these areas, which is wrong at the moment. And we need to protect and move forward and provide that win-win for both nature and our climate targets.
Ruth Williams speaking there to Nick Robinson. And that's all from us now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by James Piper and the producer was Ed Horton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nikki Cardwell. Until next time, goodbye.